All right, and welcome to the fifth episode of Megaten Marathon, which is a game-by-game journey through the Shin Megami Tensei and Persona games. This is the final episode in our series about Digital Devil's Story in Megami Tensei 2. We've been playing it as part of the Kuyaku Megami Tensei re-release, which was for the Super Famicom. In this episode, we are taking a quick journey, or not so quick journey, into hell. So, does anybody want to kind of remind us what happened in the last episode?
In the last episode, we finally fought our way through Bale, the big bad boss of the East, who turned into a frog, and I think that's where we left off.
Yep, pretty much. We got some orbs. No, we don't got orbs. We got pillars. We got to do something with these pillars.
Yeah, we have so many pillars. So previously, we beat Bale and Pazuzu. We were told that the real evil is Lucifer, and that we had to go to the original collision site where the nuclear blast happened, in, I believe, the center of Tokyo. We are now heading back to that collision site to see what's going on at Ground Zero. And so you first have to defeat Tiamat to get to the area. And in Mesopotamian religion, Tiamat is a primordial goddess of the ocean who mated with Abzu, the god of fresh water, to produce younger gods. And she's a symbol of the chaos of primordial creation. Which is pretty badass. And so, yeah, you take her on and get to the collision site.
So, reminder, though, this is an area. This is that same, like, little square area that we keep returning to for, like, 8,000 different reasons. So you could easily run into Tiamat way before you're ready to take her on.
Yeah, I think we talked about that in a previous episode, where you could get to Tiamat and get your ass kicked pretty quickly.
Although if you do somehow beat Tiamat early, I beat Tiamat just a little bit early. The person at the end of the hall basically says, "Sorry, come back later."
So now you're equipped to beat Tiamat, and you get to the collision site, where you need to finally do something with the seven pillars that you've been collecting. You need to present them to Ground Zero. And this is one of those cases where, you know, playing with a fact really helps. It would be very easy to get to this point and not have all the pillars if you did not know that you had to do that. But according to our playthrough, we did have the seven pillars. And also in fact notes, it's recommended here that you fuse an Undyne and a Gnome to fight the upcoming battles and get through some of the barriers that are coming up.
Oh, no, you don't need them for the upcoming battles. They'll die if you use them for battles. They're way too weak for the next areas. But you do need them. It's impossible to progress the game without having these two guys in your party at some point in the near future.
And it's also worth pointing out that the only way to get them is to backtrack to areas that you previously beat. When you need them, it's impossible to get the demons to fuse.
And not only do you have to backtrack, you have to fuse the demons. These are not demons you can just negotiate and find out in the wild.
So by having the seven pillars, you see a large pillar that appears. And not unlike the dog statue a long time ago, you need to circle it counterclockwise, and it raises a castle out of the ground.
I gotta admit, I kind of like that puzzle. That was a pretty neat little moment. It had been training you to do something subtly the whole game, eventually saying, like, this is going to be useful. And it never, I mean, you can get the sword in Naga if you're at a certain level. You can get fucked into hell at one point. But this is the only time where you have to use it, and I like that.
Yeah, it's a good callback. So the castle appears, and inside the castle you come across a weird purple gnome named Tyra Masakado.
Now, have you found any? Is this a demon? Because I googled something, And what I came up with is definitely not a demon.
Was it just some person's name?
Yeah, it's a samurai from about the 900s in Japan who led a rebellion against the government. He became a messenger from hell, I guess. He became the bearer of the key to the gate between hell and earth. I wonder what led to that career path.
So, yeah. Tyra will transport you into hell, which you got a little glimpse of earlier in the game when you walked around the dog statue. But now you are in HE double hockey sticks for pretty much the rest of the game. And he says, with my almighty power, I will transport you to the other side. And yeah, it's interesting because first person view of hell is actually was at least to me reminiscent of the final dungeon in the first Megami Tensei.
Sure.
You know, it has this kind of like Greek columns and archways aesthetic going on. It's not precisely what you would expect from hell.
So yeah, man, hell. I don't know. Is it basically the same size as the upper world? It feels like it might be a little smaller. Or maybe you just go through it quicker because the trend seems to be the back bits of these games. You're a lot more prepared to face than the front bits.
The maps seem to be about the same size. Like it might be the same landmass, but there's far less dungeon because on the overworld, you're going into these cities that might have like multiple dungeons in them and they'll be huge.
True. And there are definitely not as many cities in hell.
Yeah, definitely. Which, you know, not surprising in that respect.
No, not really.
So now you're in the hell. Now you're in hell, or the Valley of Despair. And you're transported to a part of hell that connects to other islands. And this is based on the orbs that you have in your possession. So if you have the Orb of Sorrow, you can transport into the Valley of Despair. And the way that you do this is you turn into a little fire icon and you float over the lava that surrounds the different islands.
I kind of think it would have been cooler if the game actually gave you the opportunity to get the orbs out of order, but you can't.
Yeah, the game from here on out is basically entirely linear.
Yeah, totally. And like the pillars were basically the one moment of non-linearity where you could miss them and have to go back. And I don't know, that's not, I guess, non-linear, but you do have to sort of figure out where they are. Weird balance.
Well, in the Valley of Despair, you find a men's shop, and there's a healer in the town as well as a save point. And you travel through a bunch of one-floor caves that don't really lead anywhere. And they're kind of a pain in the ass to traverse. There's a lot of backtracking and moving between little towns, and it's really kind of a time-consuming and frustrating process.
Plus, treasure starts to become leaner. You start not finding it as much. You start running into enemies that actually can drain your levels here.
Yeah, a ton of them, too. Like, one thing that's not uncommon for the rest of the game is to run into a pack of six or seven succubuses, or succubi.
They are the ones. Yeah, they're the ones who show up the most. But there's also, oh, I forget. There's definitely a few enemies there that totally drain you. But succubus show up from here to the end of the game.
So then you head on to the evocatively named Sad Village.
Yeah, this town's pretty small. It has a women's armor shop and a fusion cathedral. Frustratingly, they split. I think they split the cathedral and the healer into two different areas. One thing I do like about the towns in this game is that the towns in Hell, even though they're more sparse than the towns on the overworld, they tend to be better organized and easier to navigate, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah, and they usually have like one healer, one fusion guy. Like, I think there's one exception that doesn't have a healer and one exception that doesn't have a fusion cathedral. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, when you get to a city, you can rely on it to be your hub for a while.
Yeah, it makes things really easy. And most of the cities are pretty accessible.
Oh, and a save point. They all have actual save points.
Yeah, which is wonderful because there's a couple times where I had to dip out and gamble in order to keep myself in Mecca.
Totally.
So in the town, you are told, given the first hint about a specific fusion, that only Undyne can retrieve the orb at the bottom of a hidden lake. If you played other Shin Megami games, Undyne is an incredibly easy to fuse elemental that can be made by basically fusing two demons of a certain arcana together. In this game, however, as far as I can tell, it can only be fused by two very specific demons, the Troll and Harpy, both of which you cannot find here. Troll, I think you can find on one of the first dungeons, and Harpy is at like the second or third dungeon.
Harpy you can find actually right outside the starting area.
Yeah, so right outside the bunker.
Yeah.
So once you backtrack, or like us, read the fac and prepared and got this guy in advance, with Undyne in tow, you head into a little cave. As far as I can tell, there's no name for this dungeon, but it is an extended dungeon ending in a Hydra fight. Hydra is one of those enemies that seems like a boss, but then becomes a recurring enemy a little bit later. The tough thing about Hydra is that it has eight heads represented by eight enemies, all of which can attack you separately. No one enemy is particularly hard, but if you can't do AoE damage, you have a pretty good chance of this fight lasting longer than your MP. Hardest magic hitter by far is your partner, Yumiko. This guy resists almost no magic, so just with having her unload every turn with a mass spell, I think for me it took four or five turns to kill Hydra. No one head hits all that hard, though, so healing wasn't much of a problem. So once Hydra is dead, you have to summon Undyne into your party, because I hope to God you didn't try to keep her alive during that fight. And if you head back into the Hydra room, she will say, "The water is calling to me. May I go?" And she'll hop in. The game tries to trick you into leaving her behind, which is, again, a little bit irritating. But it'll ask you over and over again whether or not you want to give up and leave. Say no to all of those, and then she'll finally resurface with the Flood Tide Orb, which says it can create torrents of water. And then really all that's left to do now is to abandon Undyne and move on.
So after you're done with Hydra, you go just to the southwest of the cave. There's starts to become a lot of good demon fusions here, fusion demons that. But basically you can you've entered a new area where you're going to want to wipe out your weakest demons, recruit a few more, and you'll probably be good to go for a while from then on. So you go down to about the second floor of this cave that you've reached, and you finally find Asmodai, who, if we remember earlier, set up a Buddha statue trap that sort of screwed you over, and Izanami wasn't actually there. So we're going to try to get to Izanami now by taking down Asmodai. You gotta run down on Asmodai for me, guys. Like, what is he? Is he sounds like an angel or something?
Yeah, Asmodai is one pronunciation of a Asmodeus, who is apparently an old Jewish a demon in Jewish legend.
Ooh, didn't even know that there were demons in Jewish legend. But that's pretty interesting. So like visually, he's got three heads. He's got a ram. Another ram? Is it really two rams? I don't remember it being two rams.
Yeah, he has a couple of heads. One of them might not have been a ram, but there were two horned things, one of which has a beard. It's probably a cow, because looking at the picture of him on Wikipedia, it has a man's head, a cow's head, and a ram's head.
Oh, this is a very low-res picture. Yeah, two of them do kind of look like rams. I could see how it's not very clear what one of those heads is in the sprite. But either way, he's got three heads. He's a big monster man. He has tons of HP. Very susceptible, though, to attack down and defense down spells, which is something that, you know, we learned a while ago that are pretty useful at this point in the game. We're still going to run into a lot of bosses that we don't even need to bother with that. But for some of them, like Asmodai here, it's good to get those attack and defense down. He still resists magic. Most bosses do. Once you beat him, he drops the Orb of Insanity. Oddly, the fact we used translated it to Crazy Jewel, which sounded a little odd. So once you beat Asmodai, you go to where you assume there's going to be a Izanami waiting for you. You know, your princess, unfortunately, is in another castle. You find Izanagi there to tell you that she'd probably be very grateful for you to trying to save her, but she is actually in a Belial's castle, and you got to go there and take care of that, unfortunately.
Izanagi kind of seems like a also-ran in at least these early games.
Like, I thought in one his only presence was sort of that you were the reincarnation of Izanagi. But yes, in this game, definitely he's, well, thanks for dropping that small bit of exposition. Why can't you save her, you jackass?
Yeah.
Also in the game, it kind of looks like he's wearing pink slippers.
I mean, he's wearing like a whole pajama getup. I mean, I know it's traditional, like, I don't know, just old Japanese clothes, but it's just the low resolution of the pixel. It definitely looks like he's just getting ready for bed. So with the crazy orb, we go to
the Fields of Lunacy, also known in certain translations as Crazy Village. So you get here by backtracking all the way back to the Portal of Hell. And the ground is burning and there's impassable fire all around. And so once you finally make your way into the Crazy Village, there is a number of useful things, like continuing the theme of the villages in hell being surprisingly useful. There's a save point. There's a gun store, a healer, and a cathedral.
They really like the Second Amendment down in hell.
Right? Yeah, of course, of course. You would, that makes sense.
These aren't right, this angry letters, gun nuts. Sorry.
And there's something written on the wall. It says, in Moloch's temple, there's said to be a revival incense that can bring gods back from the dead.
Oh, I wonder. I mean, that's pretty useful advice. I mean, I haven't found any dead gods yet, but I'll be sure to remember that.
I also haven't found Moloch's temple, but good to know.
Just put that in the pocket. Maybe it'll come in handy later.
Yeah, and I wonder what god might be dead. If you have any savviness to previous games in the series, I think there's probably one suspect. Anyway, Belial's castle. You get it's surrounded by fire, and to enter, you need the orb that Undyne received from the Hidden Lake.
So I wonder, gentlemen, if you sent Undyne to go get that orb for you, and you eventually just walked away, is that orb there for you to get again later with another Undyne?
I would presume so.
I would hope so. But wasn't there... Well, there was a side quest in Megami Tensei 1 that if you fucked it up, you were just screwed.
I mean, it'd be something akin to like a game-breaking bug if like you couldn't find a way to get that orb. Maybe, you know, knowing the vintage and knowing the time of the game and how many fuck you moments there are, who knows? You might have to send another Undying down there and go through the entire process again.
But anyway, you have the orb. You use it. It dispels the fire. You can dismiss Undyne for good. You don't need it anymore. Or I love it that the game doesn't say dismiss or anything. It says abandon, just to make you feel that much terrible. Because how different would Pokemon be if it just said abandon Pikachu?
Yeah, so you get into Belial's castle. In mythology, Belial is a figure in the Hebrew Bible who later became personified as the devil in Jewish and Christian texts. He does not have that high level of influence in this game, but that's his.
In more modern interpretations of hell, he's usually like a lesser demon under Lucifer, Astaroth, Beelzebub.
Oh, yeah. And it's also worth pointing out, one thing that you will see a lot of in Megami Tensei games is that multiple versions of the same mythological entity will be separate characters. So, like, in this game alone, you're going to see multiple characters like, wait, that's the devil, and that's the devil, and that's the devil.
We find a version of Satan at least 8 times, yeah. Which I'm cool with. I'm cool with 8 Satans.
Oh, yeah.
So, if you explore Belial's castle, you will, dun-dun-dun, find a dead Izanami. And is it just me, or is Izanami, at least in these early games, constantly dead, or out of sorts, or unable to do anything?
Well, it definitely seems to be a theme that they brought over, even from the first books, where Izanami's dead and you have to resurrect her. Mm-hmm. So.
I mean, I guess that's the element of the goddess resurrection. that is referred to in Megami Tensei. Mm-hmm. So you fight Belial, and he's kind of like your kind of standard demon looking dude. He's got his horns. He's, you know, got these giant teeth. If you looked up in the dictionary, devil or demon, you would probably see an image very similar to this. And he tells you that you should burn in the flames of hell and return to the earth as ashes and dust. And you get into a battle. It's kind of a pain because he heals himself throughout the fight. If you use your status effect, Tarunda, which is attack down, you can make him pretty harmless and get through him pretty quickly. And for your trouble, he will drop the Orb of Anger.
Yeah, and with him dead and vanquished, you're then free to go back to that one little tiny central island and travel to the Lands of Rage. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you'll notice here is that our buddy Mora, the turtle, is not actually dead at the hands of that one gigantic guy that ate you. He is hanging out in hell because he heard there was good food, but he's having a really hard time finding something to his tastes.
Whoa, hold on, actually. But before you can actually go back to where you're supposed to use Mora, and he gets eaten by the monster. I forget what it's called. Zora Rasta. That's wrong.
Zataran. Zeratan. That was it.
Zeratan. If you, Zataran's the rice. If you go back to where Mora was when he got swallowed by Zeratan, he'll basically say, "Hey, sorry about that. I had no idea that would happen."
Yeah, so at least Mora's on your side. So if you explore a little bit, there's a couple of interesting demons in this area to fuse. One of them I found right here was the Nine-Tailed Fox, who is the first demon I could reliably get that had Madea Rama, which is... The fox doesn't have enough intelligence to make it super effective, but it's a good kind of stopgap healer for the next few fights.
Yeah, you know, enough to it's a Band-Aid, really.
it's a Band-Aid, and it's also... Nine-Tailed Fox is a pretty useful demon to use in some higher level fusions as well, which is nice. Once you explore a little bit, you will find the Angry Village. It has a save point, teleportation place, a healer, a cathedral, and a lady shop. Just a reminder, that is a place where you buy armor.
It's a place where you buy ladies.
Once you stock up on some fresh gear, you then head on to the Bistro Angry. This is kind of a weird puzzle shop where you have to buy certain items with specific names in order to get things later in the game. And these aren't really consumables as far as I can tell. You're just buying key items blindly.
So I don't understand. Why can't you just buy all four?
Oh, you can.
So there's really no puzzle to it. It's just, did you have the money to kind of just have all these items in your inventory? And two of them will never be used.
Yeah. And you can find such delicious meals as the UMA dinner, or the gorgeous meal, or Eucharist.
Eucharist.
Yes. I want to start a really hipster Austin farm-to-table restaurant called Bistro Angry.
So like a knockoff of Dick's Last Resort.
Oh, no, oh man, just the waiters are just like, God, and just slam their food right on the table.
It's like, God, take your communion. All right. So with all of your good food in tow, if you go exploring the village a little bit more, there is a gremlin that will tell you that Moloch has kidnapped a fairy child and tells you to head to the northwest to try to rescue him. And there's a little graffiti nearby that says, "Without Gnome, the gates of wrath cannot be opened." Gnome being the other one of the mandatory summons that you have to go back and fuse demons to get. Yeah, so once you have bought your food, you can then go back to Mora, and he will let you cross the ocean. If you explore a little bit more, there's a couple of caves, some small dungeons, and then Gnome will open a closed door a little bit deeper in the passage. Once you have the door open, you can abandon him, and you never have to use Gnome ever again.
Hold on. Hold your horses. Because you can so easily lock yourself out of this door, and I had to get Gnome again. You make sure that you clear every single thing, because, hey, let me tell you something. If you go to that next dungeon and you don't get the revival incense, you fucked up, man. Because that, and you let Gnome go already? No.
Oh, so you're saying you can't get back in that door after you've opened it the first time without him?
No, Gnome has to open
it. Wow.
Yeah, that is a gnome only door.
That is unfortunate.
So yeah, hold on to gnome for a little bit. Keep him in your back inventory. He takes up one item slot. It's unfortunate, but just keep him for a few hours. Make sure you are good and clear of this area. Yeah, I am warning, I guess, the listener who's still going to play this game. Just, you know.
The theoretical listener.
Yes.
Who isn't playing this game and also looking at the fact.
Anyway.
So, with gnome in tow, you open the door. The door leads to a cave. At the very bottom is Echidna. It's a boss fight. Apparently, I'm not sure if Echidna is a mythological creature other than in the Sonic the Hedgehog series. But it's a pretty quick fight. Drop something called the Dull Orb.
Let me propose this to you. Is Echidna a mythological creature in the Sonic universe? Or is it one of the fundamental elements of the universe? Just food for thought.
There's a little echidna in all of us.
I mean, echidna is an actual animal.
I know. I get, but, like, the Sonic universe echidnas bear so little resemblance to real world echidnas. Like, I kind of get how Sonic is a hedgehog, but I don't see an echidna in Knuckles at all.
No. I mean, you know, even Sonic is vaguely a hedgehog.
Yeah. So with him dead, you get to explore the rest of the cave, which has some teleport nonsense and teleport traps. It'll try to teleport you back kind of toward the beginning, and you got to find which teleports lead to what to get out of there. But once you're through the caves, it leads you to Moloch's Temple. If you find on the first floor the revival incense, you can also find the Fairy Child, who apparently all you had to do was talk to him, and then he has the self-confidence to find his way home on his own.
The motherfucker was just playing hide and seek. What the hell, dude? Who does hide and seek in Moloch's Temple?
Who does hide and seek in hell?
Fairy children, clearly. I mean, they have to do it somewhere, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway. So you find Moloch, right?
Hell has like a rich, like, you know, society and economy going on that I, you know, would like to know a little bit more about.
Oh, I would love to know about Hell Society. Can I tell you, like, Hell Society is one of my favorite tropes ever. Have you guys ever heard of the comic book Lucifer?
No.
I've heard of it. I've never read it.
So actually, I would recommend it to anyone who likes SMT. It has a very similar kind of thought where God is portrayed as the embodiment of, you know, structure, law, basically. And Lucifer is free will. He's the one who gave man the ability to have free will, because you had Adam and Eve. He's the one that gave them the choice to do something, to actually decide something for themselves. And so you play as, or the main character is Lucifer. He's abandoned hell, gone elsewhere. And the third trade, or for people who don't speak comic geek speak, the third book in that series, half of it is spent just going to, what's the word for a fancy, basically a cotillion in hell. It's fantastic.
Yeah, so on to Moloch himself. So Moloch is an ancient Canaanite god, Canaanites being the people that, according to the ancient Bible, inhabited Israel before the Israelites did. He is portrayed in-game as a cow snake. Pretty cool design, a cow with four arms, big muscly arms, and a snake body.
I'd be terrified.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And he shouts at you, "Sinful humans, you shall pay for your trespasses with your impure blood." But he's actually super weak. He casts fire, so if you have anyone that's weak to that, you'll get wrecked. But fortunately, the last two towns had armor that makes you almost immune to fire. So whenever he does a fire attack, he's going to do like 2 damage to your main character. He has a roar that did like 10 damage to each of my party members. After a few turns, he was down, and he drops the Orb of Doubt.
Now, I'll say for you it was easy, but for me this was the first boss where I had to, where I, like, you know, the status effect, attack down, defense down, they were in the first game. It's just they never seemed to work on bosses, so it didn't seem to matter that much. But this was the first boss where I really had to be conscious of the fact that I had status spells.
Yeah, I had problems with this one, too. And I think that this is, you know, a JRPG confession of mine, that usually status effect spells if I can go without using them, I will. And especially in the SMT games, I often, like, you know, get kicked in the ass and fail to learn my lesson.
So that's interesting, because, like, with me, it was actually Strange Journey was that, again, like, that was my first SMT game, and that was the one that got me to start. It's like, oh, wait, this game is much easier if I use attack down and defense down and things like that. And
it was, yeah, like, for me, I really learned that with the final boss of Persona 4, because there are a few spells that make him beatable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it is one of those things that, like, it with these early games, it's just hard to know which bosses are actually going to be susceptible to it, or and it's actually going to have an effect on. Whereas yeah. in the later games, it feels like every boss has some kind of weakness, and you're trying to figure out how to exploit it.
Yeah, so once you manage to down Moloch and grab the orb, if you backtrack back to the village, Angry Village, and talk to the gremlin that sent you on your kid quest, he will give you a key to a southern tower and tell you, it's like, hey, thanks. If you want to check out Belphegor's tower, there's probably some good loot there. So if you head to, this whole area is optional. Essentially, optional dungeon, optional boss fight, but you get a very powerful sword.
You guys all do it?
I did.
Mm-hmm. I did too.
Okay, yeah, it doesn't take that long. It's maybe like 20 minutes of your time.
Yeah. And Belphegor himself, he's one of the seven princes of hell. If you show up, he's pretty stoked. Even though you've just ransacked his entire house, stolen treasure, he's like, man, it's been ages since I've had any entertainment. Now show me the extent of your power. And the extent is he hits pretty damn hard. He casts fire, but he seems to have a lot more attack than he did, a lot more intelligence than Moloch did, because he hit pretty hard. But after a few chunk of turns, he goes down and gives you his sword Varja, and then flies off. Varja is actually a pretty awesome sword. It's the sword I ended up using for the rest of the game, because for various reasons I couldn't use some of the other ones that you get given. But it hits up to 8 people and does a pretty good, like, 40 or 50 damage per hit.
Oh, did you not get enough intelligence for Lucifer's sword?
I was one short by the end.
Oh, no.
Mm.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't look that up in advance.
Oh, well.
So yeah, you end up in the Forest of Confusion, and it's a crystalline area with giant crystals that are jutting out of the ground. It's similar to the Valley of Despair, except for the fact that the caves have spots where you can't use your comp, which for the most part isn't that big of a problem, but it does... You know,
they did warn you. They do act like it's a big deal for a bit, like, oh, beware.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, if you're prepared for it, you're fine. So then you go to the Sleepy Village and you find out that Astaroth is ruling the land from his castle in the north. And you better watch yourself.
Yeah, there's a great demon who speaks with a lisp. Just a little bit of character from an NPC that you don't normally get in this game.
Yeah, yeah, a little personality beat there.
The guy was so cute that I kind of read that as being like a little kid missing its two front teeth.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, like that terrible Christmas song. So you hear that the Sword Knight is big and strong and all the girls are crazy for him. But now he's sealed up in a crystal. And so you go back to the world map and there's a field of flowers. Seems like the flowers have some kind of like a drugging effect on you, because you get drowsy from all the walking and you can't take any step and you fall asleep. And when you come back to, Yumiko is being kidnapped.
Hooray! You can't. You here's the thing. Like, you lose her for the next dungeon, and you don't get an extra demon summoning slot. No. I mean, it's not the biggest deal in the world, but I feel like I should be able to have five demons right now, game.
As a Mappara addict, it made this dungeon particularly frustrating.
Oh, yes.
And you're told that, ho, 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 since you're asleep, I'll just help myself. Adding to the weird kind of like psychosexual stuff going around with Yumiko. He says, don't even think about following me. This girl belongs to me now. Farewell. And so you got to set out and rescue Yumiko.
Luckily, his castle's right there.
Yeah, conveniently. So you go to Astaroth's castle, which is pretty boring, but there are some areas with traps, which is always a pain in the ass.
Now, did the rooms that say this area smells like treasure, could you actually do anything? Or just like it smells like treasure here, I guess.
You get that message outside, then it just hurts you.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So it's that's this version, the universe's version of I'm smelling waffles right now. You're just having a tiny brain aneurysm. Jesus.
Yeah, it's just a little fake out for you.
So the Sword Knight, is the Sword Knight in here? Since we talked about it and I don't see it anywhere else in the document.
There's an optional area that I apparently skipped, according to the fact, and I suspect that's where he is.
So I found him, but to get him, you have to have a specific demon fusion, which I wasn't going to bother with. I want to say it was Sylph, and it's you have to fuse two lower-level demons from around the third or fourth town to get it. And if you have Sylph, they'll melt the ice or crystal or whatever, and you get the Sword Knight, who's level 50-something. He's a really good demon. And the Sylph begs you to fuse it with the Sword Knight, which you shouldn't do because that will result in a level 40 something demon. And thus ends the Sword Knight saga.
Yeah, I miss the Sword Knight as well. So you get into your, you make your way through this semi-frustrating, or at least fake out castle. And you find your friend Astaroth. He says, oh, ho, 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 your precious woman is being held here.
He looks like a naked angel with a sword riding a snake horse.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
Well, really, it looks like a serpent, like, rising out of the water, but it's not rising out of anything. So I guess snake, really.
He's just riding a snake around.
Also, with his headband, he kind of reminds me of a surfer guy. So he's like, hey, man, party on.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, it's funny. I got that, too.
If you can't tell, listeners, this boss fight is nothing. I don't remember any of it.
Demon bro. But if you beat him, he says, damn you, hero, or Nakajima, or whatever the hell you chose to name your protagonist as. But he says, damn you, how could I lose someone like you? And you get the Orb of Fear, and Yumiko thanks you, and she says that she knew that you would come and save her.
Yeah, right. And with the Orb of Fear, we go to the best named of the islands in hell, the Mountain of Horror. Just as it's so evocative. I can see a Dark Souls title card right now.
Before we go there, one thing that we actually left out, because I skipped this part of until a little bit later in my playthrough, is you actually, before you go to the end of the game, you kind of need to backtrack back to the, you have to go back to the Fields of Lunacy and find Izanami.
Oh, yeah, because you have the revival incense now. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is correct. Yeah, the note we got a little the notes maybe weren't as filled out as they should have been as we played this game, but whoops, live and learn, everybody. So go on. What did we do? We get something from reviving. Oh, hey, we can revive a dead god. We know a dead god, and we know a hint about reviving dead gods. So what do we get for reviving a dead god?
The robe of Izanami and the promise that Izanami and Izanagi will be watching over us.
Oh, man, brick joke, guys. Remember in the first game when Izanami said that she'd make a fine robe for me but it'll take way too long and we won't get it before we fight the final boss. Well, now here it is. Was it worth the wait?
You literally can't progress without it at a certain point, so I suppose so.
Can you really not? What stops you?
So at a certain point, you need Izanami and Izanagi to teleport you to another area, and you can only do that if you've both, well, done a certain thing a little bit later on, and you have that orb on you, or the robe on you.
Well, actually, I know what it is. You need to get the Orb of Hope from her at the end of the game. But anyway, so the functionally, the robe of Izanami allows you to walk over swamplands and damage tiles without losing any health.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it would have been more useful a few hours ago, but you have it now, so you might as well make use of it. So anyway, we go to the Mountain of Order, Dark Souls title card.
Or the name of a Tales from the Crypt episode.
Exactly. Or a John Carpenter movie from the 90s. One of those. So the area is really short. Whoever wrote this, this is a good line. You say it.
The developers might be getting sick of this game, too.
Yes, it is. It is getting a little long in the tooth at this point. We get to a cave. It leads to the fly village filled with fly men in their fancy suits. Now, just to clarify, are they men who are fly or are they men who are flies?
I mean, they are also fly and dapper, but they are men who have fly heads.
So you have fly flies. Anyway, so it's a town. You get a save point. You get a healer. You get a demon fuser guy because you gotta. So back when we told you to buy all those dinner sets, this is when you'll use the second of those four sets and you'll never touch the other two. They're just going to haunt your key items inventory, kind of like the cross-dressing items in Final Fantasy VII to remind you of what you've done. So one of the NPCs needs the gorgeous dinner set. You know, I just had it on me. I didn't even read what his hint dialogue was that you needed it. So he just was like, "Say, pal, can I see that?" And just devoured it in front of me. And in he will give you the palace stone, which allows you to enter Lucifer's castle. The village leads to a small dungeon, which dumps you outside a little further away and you get to the castle. So there is an enemy that starts appearing in this area. Did you guys have a problem with the Girimei Kala?
Is this the guy that reflects all your physical attacks?
Yes, it is. The blue elephant dude.
Yeah, he... Fortunately, I don't think... every time I've tried to run away from these guys, I don't know if it's because I leveled up my speed so much, but I was able to run away from 100% of these fights.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. They do mercifully give you the option of running away, but the first few times I didn't run into them and I just put on auto battle and I just died immediately. It was very confusing and baffling because no other enemy in the game quite works like that. But
it was especially rough because at this point in the game, I was not only using auto battle, but I was using the speed up. So I was just like, okay, yeah, oh, there's only two of them. Auto speed. Wait, what? Just wipe instantly.
Yeah, just gone. So they are one of the few common random encounters in this game that can really mess you up if you're not paying attention. So anyway, you enter a completely dark maze area after you get outside of the small village. And it's basically trial and error to get through. I mean, there's nothing really to guide you. I mean, once you start walking into the wall, your character sprite starts moving, and the answer is kind of it's up and to the right a little somehow. And then you go into a small maze-like dungeon. Instead of big floors with lots of rooms and side paths, it's a series of twisting halls. Lots of teleports and dead ends, especially when you get to like level 3 and 4. You can start just sort of falling down to the previous level. I had to save state a lot just to get through that part because it was annoying as hell.
Yeah, yep. Save stating is the way to do it, even though, like, I mean, I tried it. You know, my approach to these games is like, you know, if I can, you know, approach a new area without looking at the FAQ and just try and make it as far as I can, you know, I will do that. But this is just like the worst of that era of design, you know, it's just like teleports, dead ends, and like. Oh, it's so frustrating.
The further we get away from these early games, the less I'm going to try to rely on a guide. But these ones, I just didn't want to. I didn't want to deal with any of this bullshit. And oh man, there is a lot of little bullshit to deal with. So you get to the boss, and it's good old Beelzebub, Lord of the Flies. So here, the game will can articulate differently at this point to the end, depending on choices you've made. I assume if you didn't even save Bale from back when he turned into a frog and you killed him, nothing happens. You just get a little dialogue and then a boss fight. But if you have Bale, Bale will ask to be reunited. Oh, someone will ask. I can't remember. There's actually at this point, sometimes two different parties will be talking and they don't distinguish between who's giving dialogue. So you just sort of have to make logical guesses. So one of the demons, either Bale or Beelzebub, I'm going to assume Beelzebub, asks to be fused with Bale the frog that you have in your pocket. And you can say yes or no. And if you say no, you crush Bale Frog under your foot immediately. Not just
after
like
you're carrying him around for the, you know, like yeah. Two-thirds.
You don't just say, you know, no, what? No, Beelzebub, you cannot refuse with Bale. No, you have to crush his dreams. And that leads to a boss fight. I did it just for funsies. I just auto-battled. He went down really quick. So he's nothing.
Well, you already crushed his hopes and dreams.
Yeah, pretty much. If you say, however, you should say yes and fuse Bale and Beelzebub into Ball with two A's, and Ball will now ask to seek out Lucifer. Now, Lucifer at this point, is he still frozen or did we free him from that already?
We actually freed him, I think in the last episode.
Right. I just couldn't remember.
Yeah, when you visit Suzuki's company for the first time, that triggers him unfreezing.
So you guys have some notes about how these things look.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that Beelzebub looks kind of like someone slammed Akuma's head onto just... It's like someone had a teleporter accident with Akuma and a fly, and they just sort of got mashed together.
So yeah, imagine David Cronenberg's The Fly with Akuma and a housefly, and add like you know, just a little bit more horror because you got two heads.
I was actually
there.
Thinking the head of like you know like a member of Smash Mouth or something.
I love the details on this monster. Like you can really see some of the design really coming through in this game. His midsection is just a fly's head vomiting out its guts.
Oh yeah, totally. It looks great.
Contrasted with Bale, where like you slam this horrible monstrosity together with a frog, and you get a pretty snake lady with some wings.
Perfect sense. The two halves of a greater whole. So yeah, you have Bale. You got to go find Lucifer now. You go to the final island. I believe you unlock this a different way from all the other islands, because I know I had access to it before I actually could do anything there.
Yeah, so this is the thing where you need to have rescued Izanami and Izanagi to get through, because this is the island. This is the dungeon that I already cleared way, way back when I fell for Asmodai's trap and went to the Buddha statue.
So
you go back up to the part to the place where Izanami previously saved you from hell, and she will then send you to the real world. And yeah, or no, I'm sorry, she will send you to the Lucifer fight, I believe.
All right. So anyway, so you got a simple dungeon. Lucifer's at the top. If you have Ball in your party, you can recruit Lucifer. You should absolutely do that. He is one of the most powerful demons in the game. I think out of the box, he was a level 99, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that sounds right.
You get Ball and you get Lucifer. These are two of the best demons in the game. When did you get Odin, Evan?
I fused Odin a long time ago from a triple fusion.
Oh, I could never get a triple fusion to give me a good result.
Yeah, I actually had Odin back from the Bale fight.
Dang. Well, that's pretty epic. So anyway, at this point, through the canonical see all the endings route, this is when you get Lucifer's sword. It's the most powerful sword in the game. The catch is you have to put a lot of points into intelligence. It's like 20 or 25. Normally, you wouldn't do that because your hero does not really need intelligence as a stat that much. It helps a bit with magic resistance, but it's not so crucial as to want to, say, pump every other level into it. So a lot of people will not use Lucifer's sword. I was able to get enough intelligence to run with it for the rest of the game. It's a pretty good sword. But you can also get this sword at other points in the game, such as if you when you fought Beelzebub. Like if you beat Beelzebub after crushing Bale, the game locks you out of the See Both Endings route. And so it just gives you the Lucifer sword at that point because you can no longer recruit Lucifer, I guess. So another callback way back when, Evan, remember when you had the Nihil Blade?
Oh, yeah.
So I found out through research that if you have the Nihil Blade up until this point in the game, it evolves into the Hano Kagutsuchi.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't really know why they would do that. I guess they won. I guess that's the uncursing of the Nihil, right? Like, eventually it's like, okay, here you go. Now you can do whatever. Here's a good sword because we made you suffer. That's a pretty weird trick, but I very few people must have gotten that, but that's interesting. So, you recruit Lucifer. Lucifer tells you that the person that we should really be looking for is the one true God, because it's the one true God's problem that all these demons existed. The world used to be that all these old gods ruled their respective religion, and then the one true God ripped their god status from them and cast them into the demon world, basically so he could be the only god out there. Oh, that's so good. I start to love where this game is going at this moment.
Oh, yeah, it's so great. Oh, it gives kind of like a great like meta kind of story for why these god figures and why all these other mythological figures are identified as demons in not only this game, but, you know, future SMT games.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's definitely some sequel hooks coming right up.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, to hear Lucifer tell it, like, this whole thing happened basically because Lucifer brought enlightenment and wisdom to humans, and then God just went on a tear and started one by one conquering and then humiliating all their different gods and banishing them to hell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it really paints a picture of God as just, like, this absolutely vengeful, angry person on a warpath.
So, yeah, the game starts to really come together here. My one complaint story-wise is I really wish that at some point they had mentioned this earlier, like even briefly in passing, that the one true God was part of what was going on. But unfortunately, it's just all tucked away at the end. So you go back to the Suzuki Company, which we found again in that little pathway where we found a million things. It's very close to there.
And it's a good thing that you have God's business card still.
Yep, you still have God's, well, actually Satan's business card, because we go to the Suzuki Company, and you find a security guard.
Yeah, so you go back there, the security guard lets you in, but instead of doing the thing that happened last time and taking Suzuki to you, he just kind of lets you in the back door, where you can then explore around.
Huh, I remember that order differently, but maybe I'm probably just misremembering.
It's so, because you encountered that guard twice.
Oh, is it? Interesting. Okay, so anyway, so you find it, you get a little standard dungeon, you encounter the creator god of Zoroastrianism, Ahura Mazda, really? Like the car.
Ahura Mazda.
Interesting.
It's Zoroastrianism.
Yeah, I can't pronounce that. So he confronts you. Lucifer's light purifies him, returning him to his original form. So I assume this is a boss fight if you don't have Lucifer with you.
Presumably, yeah.
Yeah, so he joins you. He's not called Ahura Mazda anymore when you purify him, though, is he?
I think he still is.
Okay, I could have sworn that they changed that or something. Anyway, so he joins you. Nothing but elemental spells. He's really useless. But you can keep him if you want as an attacker. Not the greatest strategy, though. So you sort of escape back out, go back to the entrance of the Suzuki Company, and then you'll see the security guard, and he's like, "Haha, I'm Belphegor, Prince of Hell." And you fight Belphegor. And yeah, he's just as easy as he was the first time. And then after he's down, you meet Suzuki, the man whose card you've had for a while. He asks if you'd like some, if you'd like a drink. If you say yes, he will paralyze you with booze. Actually, I believe you have to say yes twice to his drinks for him to paralyze you. But either way, you have no reason to suspect him, and I could see anyone falling for that trap. Lucifer gets angry and confronts him, telling him to stop messing around, and then Suzuki transforms into Satan and as he ridicules Lucifer for being a slave to the humanity. So then you fight Satan.
Yep. Satan, who is not Lucifer.
Yes, Satan, who is not Lucifer, who is not Belphegor, who is not Beelzebub.
How many devils do we have at this point?
Belial. Also, in other games, Satan is also not the devil.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so in this one, Satan is the devil. This is the guy. You thought you had found the guy? This is the guy. So he's pretty tough. We are pretty close to the end of the game at this point. So we fight Satan. The high-level demons the game hands out to you make it so you don't need to play catch-up if you haven't been fusing recently, which is pretty good. I honestly, at this point, couldn't find any more useful fusions and was just sort of recruiting from the landscape. But at the same time, the storyline demons were also really good. I think by the end of the game, my entire party was storyline demons, to be honest.
Yeah, I had this. So you have Lucifer, you have Baal, you have Ahura Mazda. The only other one I had was a random guy I found wandering around who had a lot of HP named Hanuman.
Oh, yeah, he's really good.
Oh, yeah, Hanuman.
Oh, actually, you know what? I think one of my final demons was the dragon guy with the Chinese name Ang Lao, I think. Anyway, so once Satan's dead, you can go down some stairs and you can find one of the best guns in the game, the Megdio Fire. It's kind of useless at this point because guns are pretty useless in the back half of the game, but whatever. And then you head down the hallway and you to face your real enemy, the one true god. And you know, before we move on too far, I am now realizing I disagree with the note that the dungeon in the Suzuki Company is a standard dungeon, because I found it frustrating as hell. There is one floor that is, every room is like a square, so there's never any hallways. And squares, the rooms will randomly turn you around. Well, I guess not randomly, but you know what I mean. And just it was so tedious, and I could never figure out where I was going. And the exit was somewhere that I could not find.
I think this might be just SMT Stockholm syndrome, but I think I didn't mind this dungeon as much because I had in the back of my mind the last dungeon of the previous game.
Fair. It's very true. Like, this is nowhere near as bad as the final dungeon for the last game. For me, though, it was still pretty goddamn frustrating. Especially because there was like it involved going up and down stairs, and almost all of them ended in dead ends except one. Ugh. So we are now prepared. You should have your final level equipment for everybody, maxed to the gills. And we're walking down a hallway to fight God. And God keeps sending you messages like, hey, you don't want to do this. This would be a really bad idea to fight me. I'm going to fuck you up. So you get there and you meet God. And God basically gives you two options. You can obey me, or you cannot obey me. And that articulates in a dialogue choice that just says obey or fight.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the two endings. This is what we've been building towards. If you hadn't gotten Lucifer or Baal or any of that, I assume the only ending available to you is obey. So what happens? And my understanding is this ending has two different ways to articulate. It has this way, and there's a way that doesn't involve the next sentence I'm about to say. So God banishes the demons from your inventory, specifically Lucifer and his princes of hell. And then he gives you a little monologue. I have waited beyond the boundaries of time. I am the creator of all truth. I have chosen you, who have commanded the ones born in darkness and destroyed them. You have fought against many evils. Hero, you have been chosen. Come, for you and the chosen, I shall create a world of eternal bliss, the millennial kingdom. So basically, you decide, hey God, you know what? All those evil things you did, it's all right. As long as I get heaven forever.
And that's pretty big talk from a guy who basically gave you the Bond villain, you know, you and I aren't so different. Why don't you join up with me speech?
You and I aren't so different. You also created a multiverse where you torture millions. No, just me.
And, you know, you can live for all eternity in the millennial kingdom, you know, which I guess is like a, I don't know, the visual of it is so strange. It's like a pyramid that's surrounded by clouds above and below it.
God is a fan of symmetrical geometry. It's very orderly.
Because it reminds me of, you know, of the tower that was in the original game.
Right, you know, right.
Well, the weird thing about this ending is that at the very end, right before the end, right before the end credits, you get a message that says, "The evil infested world has vanished. Have we become gods?" Which kind of implies that in order to give you this fun kingdom, God just destroyed the world and killed everybody.
Mm-hmm. Which he totally did that. He totally did that.
Plus, considering that, you know, the one true God went around and killed all the other gods and sent them to hell, that's not very promising for your future.
So let's say you take the other ending. Let's say you decide to give God the middle finger and fuck him up a little bit. And he replies, "A curse on you, hero, and a curse on you, girl. You shall burn in eternal hellfire until the end of time." And it's like, man, you aren't the first guy to threaten me with eternal hellfire. That is a reference to Jewish mythology, where God struck the vowels out of his name. So anyone who said the true name of God would be cursed or smited or whatever.
Right. Yahweh.
So it's a typical battle. It's really kind of like a healing check most of the time. It's a war of attrition. You have enough power, especially with Lucifer in your party, to knock him down. It's going to take a while. I think without speed ups, this battle probably would have taken me 20 minutes. But he goes down eventually. He doesn't have any attacks that are crazy strong. He has Maziodine. But for the most part, you have enough. You probably have two good healers in your party at this point to keep everybody on the up and up.
Oh, yeah. We didn't mention this explicitly, but Bale is a wonderful healer. Not only can he do a full resurrect of somebody and a full heal, he can also do a really powerful AoE heal.
So anyone else want to articulate anything else about this actual fight, the final fight of Megami Tensei 2? It's really nothing that interesting.
Yeah, no. The only other thing to add is that God opens and closes his mouth kind of like a frog, which was pretty funny.
Oh, yeah, like the wah, 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 wah. It's pretty great on speed up because it just sort of goes real quick.
Should we hang out for a minute on what God looks like? I don't think we've mentioned that.
He's a floaty head.
Yeah, he's a floaty, bald-headed dude, covered with clouds. Kind of looks like the head in Power Rangers.
Yeah, Power Rangers. That's where I was going to go with that. Yeah. Zord or whatever.
Yeah.
And he looks just goofy enough to be the last boss of, like, a character platformer game for the Genesis.
Oh, totally. or like a Contra game, maybe. But anyway, so God disappears after you win, and you hear a voice. "How can this be? I have been destroyed by my own creations, but this is not the victory you think it is, since you have made your choice. I am only part of the entity that controls the endless cosmos. Within that space, my vast consciousness will create my body. This is not the end. You have chosen a difficult path. And so this implies something great. One is that endless cosmos is, I think, a way of them saying that he exists in multiple universes, that this isn't even the only plane of existence which he controls, which sort of sets up the greater cosmology of the Shin Megami Tensei universe that we're going to get to. And he himself is only part of this much bigger creature who I believe in later games is usually referred to as the Great Will.
Yeah, and consistent with what Lucifer told you earlier, he doesn't magnanimously just cede to you and then fade into the darkness like, good job, my children, you have become so strong. He's like, oh, no, I'm coming back. You better be ready.
Yes, they definitely, this was definitely, I think, them thinking about Megami Tensei 3 that never got made. I'm sure that that was in the planning stages at some point.
Yeah, and I kind of like the idea that, you know, he's a godhead figure, but he is not, you know, the complete all creating, all in charge, you know, individual.
Yeah. He's just one aspect of whatever creature is above him, which is so fantastic.
Yeah,
that's pretty much it. We got a little bit of epilogue here. You return to the fallout shelter that you began on. And, you know, the NPCs thank you. You can get a little bit of cute dialogues. They can go. You're excited to go back outside. If you talk to Hiroko, the Dark Hero's girlfriend, she'll say that she trusted him too much and feels regret about that. And in a little Easter egg, if you go back to the Devil Busters game. Shit. Is that in the credits or is that now?
Yeah, so now if you go back into the room with the you can actually save at this point, by the way. If you go back in there and go into the terminal, you can play Devil Busters, and it gives you a message that says, and the demons have all disappeared from the world. The end. And then it gives you a little one-panel credit that just says, programmed by A. Nakajima.
Which is Nakajima from the first game. Yeah, because we all wanted him to show up in some capacity.
Oh, and just to jump in, one weird thing that I saw that happened was when I went to the Dark Hero's girlfriend, Evan's girlfriend, I actually got a different message. For me, she said, I still have faith in him. I know he'll come back someday. Huh. Which is really sad.
Yeah, that's not what I got. That's interesting.
I know I did a couple of things differently from you guys.
Yeah.
I missed a couple side quests. I did a couple extra ones, so there must be more in there, because like if you look at the fact, like normally a fact for this type of game is obsessive. It covers every inch of the game. This one, not so much, because I don't think that many people outside of Japan have really played this game.
Yeah,
so.
No, there's definitely stuff I feel like maybe we didn't even know about in this game that we'll never know about.
Mm-hmm, but because I'm not playing it again.
Nope. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. You walk outside. This is your final act of the game. The screen changes to a shot of Nuke Tokyo, and it fades out. The battle was over. Everyone fought for a new tomorrow. But a new evil will inevitably appear, and thus a new battle will begin. But we must face it with our own strength, for the sake of all mankind. And then you get your standard video game cast roll with various credits and locations and monsters and credits for the game, and you're done. Megami Tensei 2, everybody. Let's give it a round of applause.
Yep.
Ooh.
And I mean, one of the things I love about that that closing phrase is, you know, as opposed to other, you know, like say your Final Fantasies or whatever, you know, you would end and it's like, peace has returned to the world and everything's great. And as opposed to that, and, you know, and this is one of the things that I love about the Shin Megami Tensei and Megami Tensei games is that it's like, well, it's peaceful for now, but you're still in like a nuked out wasteland and evil's going to come back and you better be ready for it.
Yeah, you completed your quest. You didn't win, really.
No.
You beat the game.
It's satisfyingly fatalistic.
Well, that's one thing that I absolutely love about how they break up the endings in these games. It's not really a spoiler because this is going to be in almost every game. You usually have a couple of different options where you can go with the good supernatural entities, the orderly supernatural entities, the chaotic ones, or there's always a middle path, kind of like the good ending here, where you can reject. You can reject the devil, you can reject God, and instead you go down a path where you're kind of fighting for the right to live in a world not dominated by the supernatural, mm-hmm. which is kind of neat.
Yeah. Like
you didn't save people. You still might kill yourselves. You just earned the right to not have God and the devil interfere.
Right.
So Megami Tensei 2, what did we think?
I found it much more playable and a... considerable improvement over the first one.
Oh, absolutely. If we are grading on a curve, this is the best Megami Tensei game so far.
Yeah, break out the big board.
I thought it was a lot more thematically interesting, and I thought that it was a lot more sophisticated as well.
Oh, yeah.
And its plot beat. You know, I mean, there was just enough, like, ease of use improvements that, despite the frustrations... There were definitely points where, you know, it was like I was like really having a good time and, you know, going through it and, you know, getting the same level of enjoyment that I get out of like contemporary JRPGs, which I cannot say for the first one.
No.
The first one definitely felt like eating your vegetables.
Well, and one of the interesting things, like especially after the first one, is like this is a shockingly complex, rich and fleshed out RPG. Like when we all played the Super Nintendo port of it, but like it was kind of, I got a bit of vertigo thinking back. I was like, wait, this was a Famicom game.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think because I played this, like I don't know. I think I said like I had like a B- level of fun with the first one. I now want to downgrade that to say that I had about a C- level of fun with the first one, and this is about a B-.
Yeah, I would go with that. Yeah, I thought B- for the previous game was a little generous, but yeah, I would be around a B-.
I guess with the last game, I guess I had so much more fun with the opening than I did with the ending. So yeah. there was a greater area of where I was having fun in this game, but you know, also lots of little bullshit that still wasn't any fun to deal with in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, hell was pretty hit or miss, but the one thing this game did well is that once we started getting back into Suzuki and it's like, okay, wait, we're going to kill Satan. We have Lucifer and Baal in tow, and like I got kind of excited toward the end in a way that in the first one I was just so exhausted and sick of it.
Oh yeah.
Right. I was having no fun by the time the credits rolled, whereas with this I was having a good deal of fun.
I liked the final boss fight, even if it wasn't that interesting to play.
Yeah, and I mean, like, the way that it wrapped up and it, like, called back to earlier parts in the game, and, you know, it's just, it's a much more sophisticated game on so many different levels, like, not only technically, but, you know, narratively as well.
Things I still want to see in future Megami Tensei games, a compendium.
Yes. the compendium being a way you can store and quickly retrieve demons that you've previously owned.
Because yes. God dang, would that be useful.
Also explanations for items and spells and just about anything.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to being able to look at a piece of armor and have it tell me, hey, this is going to make you stronger in these ways.
Oh, yes, right. Totally. I guess any final thoughts on Megami Tensei 2, gentlemen?
No, I think the only thing I'll add is that I actually like this game a little bit more than you guys. If I grade this on an NES era curve, I think this might be the best NES RPG that I've played, like just top to bottom. It holds up today in a way that stuff like Dragon Quest really doesn't for me.
I get you. For me, like the high bar of NES RPG would be like Final Fantasy 1, which I think has a formula that really speaks well to its era, but I totally get that.
Being a Sega Master System kid, I don't have a ton of experience with NES RPGs, but I would definitely put it up there with the first Phantasy Star. With
sure,
you know, as far as like, oh, yeah. You know, really, you know, doing things that are really kind of interesting and off the beaten path for, you know, what was still kind of like a nascent RPG, a nascent genre. But at the same time, you know, there was already certain tropes that were setting in from like the PC RPGs that influenced stuff like Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest. And I feel like this game and Phantasy Star both like, you know, definitely like step outside of that and do a lot, do some things that are a lot more interesting and sophisticated.
I can't wait till we have more of these games under our belt so we can start ranking them more definitively.
Yeah, two is better than one. Who'd have thunk it?
Yeah. Join us next time for Megami Tensei 3. We're not quite done with the digital devil story saga of the original novels. We have one last piece of business to cover. We're going to do a special episode coming up next week. This is only going to be a 1 week separation between this instead of the normal 2 weeks, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to put out an extra episode covering the digital devil story Megami Tensei OVA from the 1980s. It's definitely an 80s anime, so look forward to that. It's only 45 minutes. It's on YouTube. You can find it. It's in English, or at least there's English subtitles.
And should we talk about the next couple games that are coming up so people can maybe play along? Or, I mean, one of the things that's difficult is that we record a few weeks ahead. So, yeah, when you hear this, we will probably still be playing the next game, which is the first Shin Megami Tensei for the Super Famicom or Super Nintendo.
And hopefully for all of the episodes of that game, we will be joined by our good friend from the Duckfeed community, Serg.
Yeah. So that's exciting.
I didn't ask him what he prefers to be referred to as. Well, but we're going to go with Serg.
We'll go with Serg or Surge for now. And then following that, we're going to do the first Persona game. So if you have any comments or thoughts, we'd love to hear them, and we'd love to read them in future episodes for either of those games. You can email us at megatenmarathon@gmail.com.
And so third game after that, we've already decided, we've locked it in, we're going to do Strange Journey on the DS, because we need a break from these early Megaten games.
Yes, we need something modern and absolutely fun,
cleaned up a little. So that one's only available on the DS. SMT1, you can either play it on your iOS device, which is probably really hard, but I mean, the option's available, or, you know, there's a ROM with the English patched in for the SNES, so up to you.
And Persona 1, I believe, I mean, it's in the PSN store.
You can only buy the PSP version on the PSN store.
You're right.
So you cannot buy the PS1 version.
I've got it on the Vita, so if you have a Vita, that's a way to play it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you guys. So we were all playing the Vita version, which is the preferred version if you only can do the American releases. The original Persona 1 on the PlayStation 1 cut out an entire scenario and has a really wonky translation and some really terrible sprite editing.
And I think that's about it for business. Rate and review us on iTunes, if you'd be so kind. It would be great. And if you know of people who are also into the SMT games or Persona games, please spread the word. This is a pretty niche topic that we're doing here, and we've got a good number of listeners, considering that we just started out, and it's pretty niche. But yeah, we would really appreciate, you know, any kind of reviews, feedback, and you know, sharing on the social medias.
Yeah, in addition to our contact email address, again, that's megatenmarathon@gmail.com. You can also reach us by posting on our Facebook page, facebook.com/megatenmarathon.
And I have to mention this just because of our sign-off, but did we talk at all about this was Jack Frost's first game?
Yeah, we didn't talk about it, but yeah, Jack Frost is... He doesn't look right.
He does not look quite right. And this is the Kyoku sprite is re-edited. So look at the original sprite that also looks even more not right. But he is in here, and he's a pretty great little encounter. He happens around the midpoint through the game. And when I first encountered him, I wasn't high enough level to recruit him. So if I tried to talk to him, he would say, do you think you're dignified enough to speak with me? And obviously there's no right answer to that. But every once in a while, if you say whatever the RNG says the right answer is, he'll say, ha ha ha, I like your spirit, and give you some maca or something.
Yeah, he's a little more paternalistic than later games. I do, and I know this is kind of a sidetrack right here, but I do like his rare appearances in Tokyo Mirage Sessions.
Neat.
Where I don't know if it was a licensing issue or if Atlus just didn't want to give Nintendo the right to call him Jack Frost or whatever. But as far as I have played, which is pretty close to the end, he only shows up as like these kind of like, in like posters. And there's a convenience mart called the Hiho Mart.
Yeah.
And he's referred to as Hiho in Tokyo Mirage Sessions. And there's also these women who work at the mart who are wearing these little Jack Frost helmets. which is really funny.
That is pretty good. So anyway, much like our interactions with our friend Jack Frost, I must remind you all that life-ho, hee-ho, is not fair. Thank you and good night.